I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. Bob started the review with co-editor Barbara Epstein in 1963 during a newspaper strike, and the review continues to be one of the leading journals of books and ideas. Welcome.
Well, very good to be here.
How would you, the editor and creator of the New York Review of Books, describe the publication?
Well, it's a. I have to say that we started this paper, both of us, Barbara and myself, as people who came out of literary journals. I worked for Paris Review for years, and then I edited a special edition, literary edition of Harper's. And Barbara worked for years as an editor at Doubleday and of many famous, well-known books, and also on Partisan and Review. And we were both involved in quite other things until we were given a fantastic opportunity, which I think is probably historically unique.
And how did you go about deciding to start this review of books?
In 1963, the New York Times came into a kind of Luddite strike where the linotypists were striking against the new installation of digital processes. It was a doomed effort, but it knocked the Times out for 3 months. At which point, there was a dinner at the house of Jason and Barbara Epstein, for great friends of mine, and Elizabeth and Robert Lowell. And Jason made the remark that wasn't life more easier without having to read the New York Times? And so, but they suddenly thought, well, why not start a literary paper? And the next morning, Jason rang me at Harper's and said, we've been had this dinner. We thought it'd be a great time to start a literary paper. And because the publishers in New York are going crazy, they're going crazy because the books are coming out inexorably from the presses. They're going to the bookshops. There's no way to stop it, but there are no reviews. So every publisher, if you have a plausible literary paper overnight, will have to take a page of advertising. And therefore, this is the first time in history that we could start a literary journal with no capital, none. So he said to me, would you be willing to take a leave from Harper's and plunge into this effort? And I went to see the editor of Harper's, Jack Fisher, couldn't have been a nicer editor. He said, yes, go ahead, try it. It'll be a good experience for you, and you'll be back in a month. And so Barbara and I we drew up a maquette, and we met in the Harper's offices late at night and with Lizzie, and we picked out books, and then we sent them the books of the season. We sent them to the writers in the world we admire the most.
And people, who were those writers?
Well, those writers were people who often had not written reviews or for years. Norman Mailer, William Styron, W.H. Auden, Mary McCarthy, Edmund Wilson, Alfred Kazin, Gore Vidal, Irving Howe, those were just a few of the writers, not to mention Robert Lowell himself, Elizabeth Hardwick herself, and poets like John Berryman.
Did you pay these writers?
We sent the books out and we said, you have 3 weeks to do a review. We can't pay a penny. We're doing it to start a new book review. Every single one came through.
Mm.
They came through because they felt the need.
Now, had any of them written book reviews prior?
Yes, some of them had. Oh, everyone had written a book review here, a book review there, often in Partisan Review or in the Kenyon Review. Some had contributed to the New York Times. But most of them simply were not reviewing in any regular way for the New York Times or any other paper. Norman Mailer hadn't written a book review in years, and he wrote a marvelous review for us.
What was that review?
It was a review of a reminiscence, a memoir by Morley Callahan, a Canadian writer, about his days in Paris, where he knew Sinclair Lewis and Hemingway and Fitzgerald. And he, as Norman, brilliantly, he was a brilliant literary critic, Norman, when he wanted to be. He said, this is a rather perfunctory, rather dull book. But it has one thing in it that is of the greatest interest. There was a fight between Callahan, a boxing match between Callahan and Hemingway. Fitzgerald was the timekeeper, and he let the round go beyond the time of 3 minutes during which Callahan knocked out Hemingway. And Hemingway never forgave Fitzgerald. So Mailer then went on about what that meant, for someone like Hemingway. It meant a deep resentment of Fitzgerald, and also some kind of challenge to his own sense of himself. And he then speculated about Hemingway and how fragile a character he was, and how, as he wrote in this piece, I suspect, he said, he thought about suicide every day, because he was a man who was so much on the edge, he had to project this huge, confident, masculine, hairy front. That was Mailer's view.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Silvers, co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. He ran the review for 43 years with co-editor Barbara Epstein, who died in 2006 of lung cancer. So you had this impressive list of names of writers who were going to contribute
Yes.
to the review. And so how did you go about convincing publishers to advertise?
Well, we just went to the publishers' offices, because we knew many of these publishers. There was no question of who to go to. We would simply call them up and say, we have something to show you. What Jason said was true. One publisher after another, Random House, of course, where he worked, and that was a help to us, but also Holt, Doubleday, Harper's, they all took a page.
Now, incidentally, you mentioned Barbara and Jason Epstein, who
yes,
were married at the time.
They were.
And Jason was a pioneer, not just in thinking of creating this New York Review of Books, but he was also a pioneer in another way. He had come up with the idea of creating paperbacks for classics as well.
Yeah. Well, I would say what we would call quality paperback. And what he created was the quality paperback that appealed particularly to university and highly sophisticated audiences. They had existed in Europe, but this was something new in the U.S. And it's just one of his many ideas, and he's a man of extreme brilliance.
So speaking of ideas, another one of his and your ideas was this review of books.
That's it. Jason had the notion that this was the time, and his instinct was turned out to be true, because the strike continued. We put out the issue. Then Jason had another idea, which was, make bundles of these issues and send them out to the leading university bookshops. We sent them with a little note saying, we have a new paper. If you sell it, you're on your honor to send us back the proceeds. Of course, they all sold out, got a lot of attention. We got the Polk Award that year for taking some kind of initiative. And then we put out a second special issue. And by that time, we had decided to go for it.
So you decide after these two issues, these two successful initial issues, to proceed on a regular basis.
And try and raise money. We didn't need that much, actually. And funnily enough, one of the biggest contributors was Brooke Astor. We'd heard from a friend of hers, Blair Clark, who was a friend of Robert Lowell, that she was interested in the paper. She'd been reading it. And he called us up and said, you better go see her. We went round, and she had the paper. She'd been reading it. She said she'd been a book reviewer herself in her day when she worked on magazines. How much time did we give these reviewers? She asked us. And she put in, a large sum of money, became one of the principal stockholders.
Do you remember what that sum of money was in 63?
Well, it was over $50,000.
And do you remember going to her apartment?
Very well. We had spent the afternoon there talking about book reviewing.
What was most memorable about that experience?
Well, I was most memorable was her. Her vitality and her absolutely serious and genuine interest in article after article. She was someone who had written book reviews herself as a young woman for the early Vanity Fair. And she had been an editor for years, on House and Garden. She was very much a journalist, Brooke.
Was this manna from heaven? Things are going well. People are reading the review. You're getting funding.
We all had friends who put in a little money. But here again, and I want to point out more about the genius of Jason Epstein, he conceived something which was crucial. He divided the shares that we had into two groups. The B group was the group of contributors, of the people who bought the shares, like Brooke Astor. And the A group was us, just the Lowells, the Epsteins, and myself and Whitney. That's it. And we had A shares. And according to the bylaws of this corporation, the people who owned the A shares had all the power, power to appoint the editor, for example.
So there was this independence that was maintained.
More than independence, it was freedom. In other words, this is a, I would say, if there's any single factor that we have benefited from, it's been freedom. In other words, there was no proprietor, no boss, no foundation, no government, no group of any sort that could tell us what to do. We had no, if we were making mistakes, it was us. If we were going to take a difficult position, it was us. So therefore, when a history presented us with difficult choices, for example, the Vietnam War, we had no one to say to us, now look, we must not criticize this war too much because we don't want to seem too, let us say, failing in our support of the troops or something like that. So we had freedom not only politically, if we encountered conundrums and challenges from history, but we also had freedom to experiment. We had no one said, oh, you're a book review, you can't do this or you can't do that. We, anything that we felt we wanted to do that would be marvelous for the paper, such as publishing an article on the movies or sending some writer we respected on a voyage to report on some far-off place, we could.
You talk about freedom and independence, and that's been very important to you. And your publisher, Ray Hederman, seems to have given you free rein.
Well, I think it's been, for the last 25 years or so, been a crucial element in our lives. Along came Ray Hederman, who had been editor and owner of most of the papers in Jackson, Mississippi, and wanted to establish himself in New York, who knew the New York Review, who admired it. He came and made it and said he would like to be publisher and take over the ownership. And we were in a quandary because we thought it would be very nice to have a terrific publisher who would improve the paper's business. But how would it affect us? And, of course, we were extremely suspicious. But after several months of conversations, we suddenly realized that Ray Hederman was absolutely sincere in extending this absolute guarantee to us of freedom, editorial freedom. He said, why should I want to change it? He liked it. And he kept his promise.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. We'll hear more from Bob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. Bob started the review with co-editor Barbara Epstein in 1963 during a newspaper strike, and the review continues to be one of the leading journals of books and ideas. The New York Review of Books is not just a critique of books, but it is also a place for political commentary and commentary about world events. What's an example of that?
V.S. Naipaul. He joined us very early as one of our reviewers. He wrote articles for us, and he expressed interest in what was happening in Argentina, where the generals and colonels had taken over, and there was a lot of torture. And this was a great human rights problem of the time. And a friend of mine put up some money and bought him a ticket. He stayed there for weeks, and he wrote the most brilliant reportage, not only on the horrors of the colonels, but also on some of the ugly tendencies of the Peronistas. And he showed the populist impulse and the often rather suppressive elements, both of the military and of the Peronista elements in Argentina. And it was a great, really went beyond that to describe a culture of violence, a culture of quandary and disappointment in Argentina. Now, that's what a writer like that could bring to a political, historical situation. Same thing with sending Joan Didion to El Salvador during the war there.
When the New York Review of Books had its debut in 1963, What was the New York Times' reaction to your debut?
Well, I don't remember any particular reaction. The New York Times was a very august and very self-confident and very important paper. And it, by the way, it's not really competitive to the New York Review. They have a completely different task. They're supposed to review. They have a mission to review comprehensively the most important books, or most books that come out. From the very first, we said we will not review most of the books. We will review the books of the season that interest us, and we'll put aside a large numbers of popular books, which may not interest us, except, as we said in our original statement, from time to time, to call attention to a fraud.
Huh. What does that mean?
It meant that some books are really very deeply vulnerable and need, and one has to criticize them.
You just can't resist.
Well, it's a public service.
I see. Do you ever feel the desire to write your own pieces? Because from the inception, you were the editor. You were
not a
writer. Has that created some frustration for you?
No. And I feel that's been a lucky, because you know there are various kinds of people who edit, and some of them are indeed frustrated writers and are always working on their novel or something while they edit. I've always thought of the editor as a middleman. He's a middleman and essentially an admirer, a fan. On the one hand, he admires great writing. He admires the people of brilliant minds. On the other hand, he wants to bring their work to readers. He's between the two. I think it's a mistake for that person, the middleman, to start competing with these great writers. On the contrary, what you want to do is find ways to present their work to a wider public.
Have you always been in the position of an editor? And I'm talking about even in your childhood.
No.
Where instead of being the star, the writer, you were that person behind the scenes.
No, for years I worked as a journalist. I worked for the United Press in Washington. I worked for magazines. I wrote articles for papers while I lived in Paris to keep the ends of life together. but what I dreamed of was working with great writers, the most talented in the world.
I want to go back to your earlier life. You grew up on Long Island.
I did.
And your father was a Wall Street guy who became a poultry farmer.
He was a businessman. He'd been a farm boy in Connecticut as a boy. In the late 20s, he had enough money to buy a farm, which he thought we were going to, had a flat in the city. He thought we were going to use this farm as a kind of nice country place. Then the Depression came, and he retired to the farm. We had 5,000 chickens. We had goats. We had some crops. In those days, there was a big woods, and it was like, for children, a rather a paradise. My mother, who had been a music critic and the an old New York Globe, and settled for this life in the country, but she took us every Saturday to New York to hear the Ernst Schelling children's concerts and go to a museum in the city. She wanted us always to have a touch of city life. And my brother and I were always congratulating ourselves on having had such a good time.
You went to the University of Chicago and graduated at 17
yes.
years old.
It was 1945. It was just after the war. There were thousands of veterans coming into the campus. The whole world seemed open politically, culturally. My roommate at one point was a 30-year-old bomber pilot. And there was enormous freedom on this campus, and yet there was a commitment on the part of the university that every student in the college would essentially read the same curriculum, from Aristotle to Bertrand Russell. Everyone read Freud, everyone read Marx, everyone read St. Augustine, everyone read Plato, everyone read Dostoevsky, everyone read Flaubert.
Was your experience at the University of Chicago germane or formative or
seminal? I believe I owe it practically everything, because, as you'll see from the New York Review, in every issue there is an article on science, there is an article on art, there is an article on literature, there is an article on social questions. And so the range of and demands of that particular form of education left its mark on all of us.
At what point did you decide you wanted to be in the literary world and become a writer or an editor? When did that happen?
Well, it was odd. I went on to Columbia. I studied philosophy there. And then I was, a friend of mine was in Washington and said there was a job at the United Press they could help me get. And I did work there overnight. Then I got a job as press secretary to Chester Bowles, governor of Connecticut, at a very young age. And then I was drafted. And because I'd been press secretary to governor, I think it was during the Korean War, they sent me to Paris and to the NATO headquarters. And in those years, I met the editors of the Paris Review. And I met George Plimpton at that time. And during
the founder of the Review.
He was running the Paris Review. He was there in a little office. And he said to me, you know, if you're here in the Army, when you get out, why don't you join us? So I did.
It's interesting. It seems like you became a writer. It almost happened to you rather than you're having a sense of agency about it. When you became press secretary, it wasn't that you were looking to become a press secretary.
No, you're right. They asked me.
Or with the Paris Review, people asked you to join. So
that's
there didn't
right.
seem to be much of an entrepreneurial engine somehow.
No, it was a question of miraculous opportunities opening up. You're so right when you say that. I feel again and again the luck of life that when you bump into somebody and you get to know them and they say, hey, why don't you join us?
And similarly, with the New York Review of Books, you were asked.
That's right. And the same when Jack Fisher came to Paris one day and he said, look, I've seen your work on the Paris Review, and we'd love you to come into New York to be an editor on Harper's. And he said, we'll pay your way back. We'll give you some money for a flat. And I thought, well, who else is asking me to back this way? And why not give it a try?
It seems that despite your being asked and not having a sense of agency about these things, you really have taken on leadership roles once you have embraced whatever.
Well, I think you're putting it away. I hadn't really thought about it, but you're right. These were marvelous lucky chances that have come to me in life, and marvelous lucky jobs, really.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Silvers, co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. The Review has a circulation of roughly 143,000 and has managed to be profitable since 1966, 3 years after it was started. You now have a circulation of 143,000. How has it come to that? How do you think you've mustered or acquired those readers?
We can't believe it. We never had any idea we would be so big. Barbara and I always felt that that there was a whole range of publishing, editing questions that we wouldn't go into. We never took surveys. We never had focus groups. We never did anything in the marketing. Our idea was that if you have brilliant articles that seem marvelous to us, seem interesting and exciting, that people will read them.
Still, even if your content is appealing to a diverse group of people, it's still another to actually get those people to sign up for the
It is,
the
of
magazine.
Course, and it is a difficult thing. But that is, I think, another key to the paper, which is this, renewal. The key to the business, as I understand it, and I'm not a great expert on it, but it is basically how people renew. So our renewal rate is well over 80%. That's one of the, considered in the business, I believe, a very high rate.
Now, let me ask you about your relationship with Barbara, because
it
was a marriage, essentially, for 40-some-odd years. How was that relationship?
Well, you know, it was the most amazing thing, because Barbara and I were great friends before we started the paper, and we liked each other very much, and we had a... She had a number of friends and people who were, in a certain sense, she dealt with. I had a number of friends and other people and others who I dealt with. And there was a kind of natural division between us, but we didn't feel competitive. And we had a kind of complicity. In a certain sense, we hardly often had to talk at length because we were talking a little shorthand of our own. And we would pair every manuscript back and forth between us. And so every writer, although they didn't know it often, had four eyes going over their work. And it was something that became a kind of series of understandings and intuitions that we were very happy in this collaboration.
It seems like a trusting dance.
It was. You see, another point about life together, and this is something I miss very much, is that we had our own jokes about everything. We would sit and giggle and laugh about what we were doing quite often. And that was a great bond between it.
It sounds to me like, yes, it was a professional marriage. You trusted each other.
Yeah.
You laughed.
We had fun together.
It seems like a recipe for a marriage as well, for a relationship.
Well, Barbara had her own marital life, and so did I. So that was something else.
What do you think she would say bothered her about you, if anything?
Well, question. That's a good question. I think that sometimes you might say that I might have been about certain articles over demanding too much.
Do you think you're over demanding?
No, but I think that this was something we both might have said about the other.
I want to go back to the relationship question, if you don't mind.
No.
Because again, it does seem like there could have been a loving relationship beyond the professional. And I know she had her married life and you had yours, but was there ever any discussion
of
that?
No. Funnily enough, I think that we felt, both of us, that there was a particular excitement and honor even and vocation in this chance we had, this extraordinary opportunity, which two editors never have had before, probably, to do whatever the hell they wanted and still survive. That particular fascination with the possibilities of the paper was consuming.
In a way that didn't need anything outside of that.
That's what I mean.
I want to talk about your personal style.
Yeah.
You had a 60th birthday where writers contributed to a book of sorts for Bob Silvers.
That's right. It was not my idea, I can assure you. But Elizabeth Hardwick and some other people got together and they did that.
One recurring theme throughout that book was, aside from the immense respect they hold for you, how meticulous you are and how demanding you are as an editor. They say that you worked all hours of the night. Tell me about your work life.
Well, it is true. I mean, I do envy editors who have a life arranged with deputies and associates and so on who take over a lot of the work. And they are like conductors of an orchestra. But I can't do that. And I pick up the manuscript. I can simply let my eye pass over things and say, oh, well, somebody else will look after this. I feel I must concentrate on it to try and make it the best possible thing. And also we had very strong views about actual prose. The whole group of words that which you don't find in the New York Review.
What are some of those words you won't find, or those
well,
phrases?
Well, for example, we are very suspicious of the phrase "in terms of." People use it all the time. But then you say, well, what are the terms? So we feel that we felt, Barbara and I, that the word context was being abused. Now the context is everything. It's the surroundings, it's the background, it's everyone is contextualizing, and so on.
Now, writers have said that you have found them at all hours of the day, and in all countries of the world, just so you could ask them to please check punctuation in a sentence. For instance, I think it was Ronald Dworkin who said that his wife was complaining that Bob Silvers calls every Christmas to have this to have an editorial conversation, and Ronald said, "Oh, she exaggerates. He's called on Christmas only twice."
Well, the horror of it is that as we go to that, our schedule has always been terrible in the sense that we have a January issue that does go to press around Christmas, maybe not Christmas Day. But there's a real question here. We have a code, Barbara and I, and I believe in it. which is that no word or even punctuation mark will appear in the paper that the author hasn't approved. So in some of these instances, many editors and many magazines would simply change it. But I believe in that while on the one hand we're very demanding with the writers and ask them to rewrite things and we'd make many suggestions to them of our own, in our own writing, that the final text, they must approve every word and every comment. It must be theirs in the end.
And that means having to call them in Thailand.
And if there is, and suddenly if you want to change the sentence and take out the semicolon and put in a period, it may not be what they want. And so you have to call up and say, is it okay?
What are some of the places, where are some of the places you have called at midnight?
Well, you know, you don't think about it in advance, but then someone says, well, I say, where can we get hold of Pankaj Mishra? We have this piece and there's something, there's a huge paragraph here. We must break it up. And someone said, well, you know, he was in London last week, but he's gone to Tibet. So there's nothing to do but call the Star Hotel in Tibet.
What has been the most rewarding part of editing the New York Review of Books?
You know what? If I feel I have a good issue, it comes out every 2 weeks. And so that they have, say, 20 articles, 40 books reviewed, and so on. So I look at it, and I think, well, there it is. There's a mixture of things. There are some articles I love in it, some articles I think could be better. But the most rewarding thing is when you pick up that issue. I've done it, it's out there, and it's going to take its place in the world. People are going to fight over it, whatever. But that's it. You've done it. It exists. You've done it.
Bob Silvers, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Bob Silvers, the co-founder and editor of the New York Review of Books. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now, rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. the thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
See, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher. And so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away.
He died of high blood pressure and hypertension. Basically had a heart attack, yeah.
So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And today, that school is one of the top-performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly, and it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. Mm-hmm. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family. And part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily. I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch. So I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the academy off the ground or to make the idea of the academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. You know, one was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and you know, we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle, and she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear and said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa. And, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18 running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back at a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus. And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to
to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. Next time on From Scratch, we'll meet Professor Daphne Koller, co-founder of the online education company Coursera.
I got an email from an 86-year-old. She doesn't feel comfortable going to college. What's this old lady doing in class? So she is taking a Coursera course and meets up with a bunch of other octogenarians every week in the public library to do a study group.
I'm Jessica Harris. Join us next time on From Scratch.